As I said earlier, the music career of Christian Hoffmann has always overlapped many areas at the same time. In 1981, as Klaus Nomi was releasing his first albums in Europe, Christian had a band called the Swinging Madisons. Can you tell us about that band?
The Swinging Madisons, it's sort of hard to describe what that period was like, because everyone was doing 30 different things. So at the same time as I was doing the Swinging Madisons, I was still in the Mumps, who were about to break up. I was already doing a band with Klaus. I was also doing a folk band with Ann Magnusson called Bleecker Street Incident. So my idea of the Swinging Madisons was to do a song where I could sing Volare. That was about as far as it went. I loved Bobby Rydell's version of Volare. And then I thought, like, I should just start a joke band where I get to be the lead singer, because I never get to be the lead singer. And then we did that, and then I wrote a bunch of very silly songs. And that was another weird thing. It was a band that just started as a joke, and I had a couple members of the Mumps in it, and I made them all wear turbans the first time we played, and I just lay on the floor and screamed. And that band became very successful very fast and got a record contract after we were together less than 3 months. Whereas the Mumps, you know, worked for almost 7 years and never had a record contract. So it was just a bizarre one of those things. I wanted a band that was just fun. I'd been in bands that were too angst-filled for too long, and I thought, like, we can get together and have a few laughs and dance around, and I can do a kind of cross between rockabilly, Bobby Rydell, and a little bit of soul. Although, if you've heard my music, you know I have no soul.
Well, you released a 5-song EP, and
yes.
What's your favorite track from that?
Mediocre Dream, which I'm actually redoing for my new album. I think it was a really good, solid tip of the hat to Nuggets-type 60s garage psychedelia, but it also, I still think the lyrics are pretty funny. I mean, it just, I was watching TV late one night, and somebody was talking about their dreams, and I thought, like, God, your dreams are so mediocre. And then I thought, like, America's dream is mediocre. It's like, can't they aspire to anything better? And so I thought that was a funny title, and I still think it's pretty funny.
What about their version of Society's Child?
Society's Child, I have to say, is I adore that song. I don't have an ironic relationship with that song. I love Janice, and I think her entire first album is genius, but it also seemed like a song that was timeless and had something new to say to every generation, and I felt like it, the same things I was saying with Guilty White Liberal and the Swingy Madisons, I was saying, like, we think we're beyond racism, but we're really not. You know, we think this is in the past, but it isn't. But since I was in that frame of mind of just sort of sending everything up, I was sort of sending up Society's Child at the same time. I was trying to be as outrageous as, you know, how suddenly Aunt Jemima cookie jars had become very collectible then, but it was with an ironic wink that it was cool to collect them because, of course, we know that they represent slavery, but it's kind of like we're so smart that it doesn't really represent that. It represents this kind of outre outsider aesthetic. And so I wanted to say, but it's still racist. And so that's why I did that song. And that song was actually for the second edition of the New Wave Vaudeville show. I sang that, and I came out in a little sailor suit, and I was singing it really sweet and sincerely. And then this girl came out in a Ubangi mask, and she tried to be my friend, and I put on a Ku Klux Klan hat and chased her around the room. And it was all very heavy-handed and supposed to be meaningful. But it was the only act in the entire show that got absolute silence after we performed it. There was no clapping, there was no booing, there was nothing. It was just like everyone was stunned. So I don't know if that's good or bad, but it was something.
Come to my garden, baby. Face is clean and shining, black as night. My mama went to answer now. You know you look so fine. I could understand your tears and your shame. She called you
Negro girl
instead of your name. When she wouldn't let you inside. When she turned and said, but honey, she's not our kind. They say, I can't see you anymore. For a while, baby, I'm only society's child. When we're older, things may change, but for now, this is the way they must remain.
I'm sure you had to be there to get the full effect of that song. Okay, so there was an EP, there never was a full album, but from your website I got an unreleased demo called Belinda, and Belinda turned into someone my listeners will know.
Yeah, Belinda's about Belinda Carlisle from the Go-Go's. You know, when the Mumps came to California, we were the first new... This is another thing that nobody ever says, tooting my own horn again, but we were the first New York band to play in California. And everyone went insane, and I do believe that lots of little young whippersnappers decided, hey, those New York bands, they're really friendly and nice, let's start our own band. So I do think we had something to do with helping the LA scene start, but it would have started without us anyway. But Belinda was there in the audience, and they were already, I think, working on the Go-Go's. And I just adored her. You know, if I had been straight, I would have had a big crush on her. But since I wasn't, I just loved her voice and her legs and thought she was entertaining and wonderful.
Before I get any further, I want to say I grew up in the 60s, and my first teen idols were Ricky Nelson, Bobby V. So I love the photos of you dressed up as Tad Among.
Oh, yeah. I have to say, there's that one photo of me that I put on MySpace, and everybody goes like, oh, my God, you were so handsome. No, I wasn't. I was a big goon. I was thinner then. But Anya Phillips took that picture, and she did my hair. She dyed my hair seal brown before the picture. She combed my hair, and she took the picture from an angle that made me look really good. I do think, like, I was known amongst certain homosexuals in the milieu that I moved in as having a goony beauty. And so I do think I had some sort of appeal, but I never looked as good as I did in those pictures. It's kind of like, yes, the camera does lie.
In the mid to late 80s, you were in a folk parody band called Bleecker Street Incident. Tell me about that.
Well, that was when I first met Anne, and she was directing the New Wave Vaudeville show, and she was so much fun, and she would come see the Mumps all the time, and we just thought she was so wonderful and charming and beautiful and smart and talented. And I'd always loved Joan Baez, and I still have a kind of difficult relationship with Joan Baez, because I think that everything's fantastic about her, but her voice. And, of course, she's a singer. Her voice is a little too shrill and piercing for me. But I love folk music, and I think all of the English folk she sang with all those minor key melodies is really evocative and stirring and poignant. And so I just thought, like, well, the time is ripe to do a folk parody band. So it was just another one of those things, like calling Klaus. I called Anne, and I said, don't you want to just do something? And she said, okay. And I said, let's do a folk band. And she said, okay. And so then we decided to do it, and she knew all the people that ran the Pyramid, so that sort of became our home away from home, and we played there all the time and just wrote a bunch of songs and played, and then we played here in L.A. a whole bunch of times. We came out to L.A. and played a place called the Lassa Club, and it was a minor sensation. I would say, you know, we could sell out a little folk club and get a big article in the L.A. Times. It was like our media presence was a lot bigger than the band was. We did that band, and it was really a lot of fun for a few years. And we actually got approached by Giorgio Moroder, which is bizarre. And he had us record a bunch of demos in his studio in Hollywood, and then he passed on us. But if that folk band had become another Donna Summer, that would have been very exciting.
How long was that act together?
I'd say it was together, you know, 3 or 4 years. It was together a pretty long time. It was like, you know, for a joke that we were going to do as a one-off performance. You know, we sang LaLaina at the Pyramid, and I hold a skull with flashing. It had a light bulb behind its eyes, so it would flash off and on. And Anne wrote a poem to it about someone who got some junky girl that had gotten run over by a bus. And then we sang, "That's Your Rotten Life, LaLaina." It was that lame.
And even the group name, Bleecker Street Incident, is a parody, spelled not like the Greenwich Village street name, but B-L-E-A-K-E-R. There was no official release for that group, but on Christian's site, I found this funny track called Trigger Happy. Remember, this is folk parody.
Look at all the kicks I found. I'm so happy, trigger happy. I'm so happy now. I'm so happy, trigger happy. I'm so happy now.
Well, I first started shooting over 10 years ago when I got an old Civil War musket and library book to teach me how to use it. Now that I have a family of my own, we're all getting into the act. My husband Jim has an Uzi submachine gun. Our little son Tommy has a .357 snub nose. And our little daughter Sally, she's only 2, we bought her a blowgun. And we like to go into our national parks and forests and shoot small woodland creatures. Skin them and eat them alive. Mmm, tasty. This summer we went to Australia. Bagged me a few wallaby. Jim hit a kangaroo with a jeep. And little Tommy, he's so cute. Why, he shot one of them fuzzy koala bear right between the eyes. Next year, we're going up to the Arctic Circle and club us some baby seals. Now, that's real sport. You know, I get so sick and tired of hearing those bleeding heart liberals telling me that I can't own firearms. Why, it's unconstitutional. I tell you what I tell them. I say that when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. Thank you. Well, they always try to put you down, and they kick you when you're on the ground. Now the shoe is on the other foot, and look at all the kicks I've found. Well, I'm so happy, trigger happy, I'm so happy now.
I encourage you to visit Christian's website, logically found at www.christianhoffman.com. It's very interesting and covers a lot of ground, just like his career has for the last, 30 years. There's a long list on this site of artists that he's performed with, written with, and played on their albums, like Lydia Lunch, Elvez, Dave Davies of the Kinks, Abby Davis, and Ann Magnuson. The list is quite long, and if I added a couple hours to this show, I couldn't do it justice. Instead, I'm going on to 1993, when Christian released his first solo album called I Don't Love My Guru Anymore.
I saw a special depth of soul in her eye, and she looked through me and she just passed me by. Oh, the glad, handsome mind and starlight as I got in my car letting bygones wilt and die. It wasn't so much that I caught her in debt, or all the things she said I'd rather forget. Oh, but I was thinking of a moment when all she had to show meant a faith enhancing astro. Yeah, so I don't love my.
So all that kind of got you ready for your solo album.
My first solo album, actually, it got me ready for that. I love folk music, and I was in love with folk music, and I was also in love with the Left Banke, and, you know, the idea of doing an album with lots and lots of strings and everything at a time when nobody was interested in that, and it sounded like you would be shot if you did it. You know, now everybody's doing it, but back then it was like there was Pearl Jam and Nirvana, and I decided to do an acoustic album that sounded like the Left Banke. But what really happened was that the Swinging Madisons had broken up, Bleecker Street Incident had broken up, Mumps was long gone, Klaus was dead. I was here in L.A. I'd only moved here to be with the Swinging Madisons, and then I was here, even though I didn't like this town, I just sort of was living here and didn't know how to get out. And I thought, okay, I'm going to quit music. It's too painful, and all my experiences in it have led to nothing. No matter how big you got, nothing good ever happens. And then I realized, even when I quit music, I just kept writing songs, and I kept writing these acoustic folk songs. And so it was actually a very low ebb in my musical career, where I was struggling with ever being involved in music again. And then my manager came back into the picture, and he said, these are the best songs you've ever written. I can get these released if you just record an album. So I recorded an album of those songs that I was never going to record because they were all too sad and straightforward. I thought, you know, they were kind of naked. I wasn't guarding myself the way I did in every other project by making it silly or ironic. And that ended up being my first album. And that sort of started me on my way to whatever I ended up being.
Well, on the first album, an artist I've interviewed before, Frank, sang backups on two of the tracks, including Odd Man Out. Can you talk about that song?
Well, that song is specifically a gay liberation song. I was letting myself, because the folk idiom lends itself to being not only straightforward about being loved and brokenhearted and weepy and emo, which I know emo has worn out the welcome of any of that sort of stuff, but also folk lends itself to being overtly political. And so I felt free with that song and with a song called My Generation and with a song called Garbage Turns to Gold to say, I'm going to do what is in the tradition of folk music and address issues. And so Odd Man Out, just, it was another song about, like, you know, you may think you're being liberal, but really you're not, and really there isn't a seat at the table for gay people right now, and we're struggling with it, and we're doing better than we used to, but there still is a lot of work to be done. And I was good friends with Frank, and Frank is one of those people, you know, who's, first of all, if she talks to you, you just feel like a light is being shined on you, and you're warm, and you're in the company of the best person you've ever known. And then her songwriting is so strong that I felt so lucky to be her friend that I was hoping she would be on the album some way or other, and then she was. So it was really exciting. I just adore her.
Once upon a fairy tale, a flimsy man wore lavender and lace, and the lie was gospel. If this gospel saves, it's only saving faith. Now the crop you once mistook for pansies are all wilted nearly flat as the earth erodes for want of water, and you say I'll drink to that.
Before I get to your next album, during that time period, you were tapped for several tribute albums honoring the Hollies, the pre-disco Bee Gees, and on Melody Fair from 94, you did a Bee Gees song, Lemons Never Forget, and you've told me that may be the best thing you ever recorded. Why do you say that?
I say that because it just, sonically to me, it's the most satisfying thing. I mean, I love that song. When they did that album, it was originally with a different label, and I had heard about it, and I was trying to get on it, and then the person who ran my record label said, that label went out of business. We can buy the project, and we'll put it out, and then you'll be on it. And so, in a weird way, I have a very selfish responsibility for that album never seeing the light of day, because I just wanted to do some Bee Gees songs, because they were really influential on me. It was like sort of what I heard in my head. And you usually try and approximate what you heard in your head, and you're satisfied with what you end up with. But that record came out as exactly what I heard in my head.
We're up to 1996 in the album Earthquake Weather. Here's a little of the title track.
That forms upon your palm tells you it's earthquake weather.
I want to move on to your second album, Earthquake Weather. And there was a review of that album from around that time. And in the review, you were quoted as describing your music sensibility this way. If Leonard Cohen and Leslie Gore had a baby, I would have been that baby. What do you think of that quote now?
I think it's true, because I think that my roots are very firmly in disposable pop. I mean, if you could call the Beatles disposable, which some people might, but I love highly crafted, catchy melodies. That's what I love. I love ABBA. I love Leslie Gore. I love all those frothy bubblegum singles. I love corporate psychedelia, where it's much more based on melody and sort of sensation than it is on being bluesy. So I definitely believe that, but I do aspire to true poetry, and I probably fall short most of the time, but I think Leonard Cohen is the greatest song craftsman in terms of poetry that I know of. There might be somebody obscure that I haven't heard yet, but you listen to the Tower of Song, it's like, he's unapproachable. He's the guy. I think it's funny because, like, when I was playing in Rufus Wainwright's band, we would, every Tuesday night, we'd go and hang out in Lorca Cohen's apartment, which is under Leonard Cohen's apartment. And Rufus is not a shy flower. You know, he thinks he's the greatest genius of all time. But you'd hear these footsteps creaking on the floor upstairs, and Rufus would go like, oh, it's the great man. And I feel that way about Leonard Cohen. I'm suspicious of him, but I'm in awe of him.
And I can't resist sharing a little of the song Man in a Hurry. I love the ethereal opening to the song.
It seems that certain willful
fateful acts made me a stranger to the facts. But no one ever said this was a race. So pardon if I find it rash, this breathless sprint, this madcap dash to etch the map of life into your face.
In 2002, the group Rosenstolz had a hit song in Germany with a cover of Total Eclipse, featuring Mark Allman on vocals. What did you think of that version?
Should I bite the hand that feeds me? But I was very excited that someone was going to cover it after I got my publishing back, and they did it completely without any promotion. They just decided to do it out of the blue. And I actually like their disco version of it. But I adore Mark Allman. I think he's one of the greatest voices of all time. If I had a tenor that I could work with as opposed to the countertenor that Klaus was, I would love to write a song for Mark Allman to sing. I love The Stars We Are, that album. He's just amazing. So when I heard his kind of rote reading of the song, which I felt like it sounded to me like he came into the studio, spent 5 minutes there, and then left and didn't concentrate on the song. The artist in me was kind of disappointed because my expectations were so high. I had no idea it was going to happen. It was like a gift from heaven, and I have nothing but high regard for him. But I thought that there was going to be some magic there that didn't happen. On the other hand, it paid for me to have my roof replaced. So that was exciting and disappointing at the same time.
Again, I'm going to have to gloss over Christian's work with other artists to bring us up to 2002 and an album I found irresistible. Imagine Christian singing duets with Rufus Wainwright, Elvez, Paul Rubens, otherwise known as Pee Wee Herman, Lydia Lunch, Van Dyke Parks, and many other of his co-conspirators from over the years. Many of these folks you may not have heard of, but you should have. The album is called And that's displayed by the ampersand symbol on the CD cover. What inspired that album?
What inspired that album was a record that never happened. I was standing, I think I was watching Turbo Negro at Spaceland, and Belinda Carlisle, who, as you know, was sort of a friend of mine. We're not close friends, but especially because she lives in France, but we remained in vague touch over the years. And she used to just love it when the Swinging Madisons played Having My Baby. It was her favorite song. So I said, let's do a single. Let's do a duet doing Having My Baby. And she said, sure. So I recorded the backing track for Having My Baby. And she got laryngitis. And she couldn't come to the session. And then she moved back to France and I never saw her again. So that never happened. And then my record company said, well, why don't you just do a whole album of duets? So it was kind of like a byproduct of a silly thing that never occurred. And it wasn't my idea at all. And I was kind of resenting it because I had all these songs ready for my third album, and then I was forced into this kind of concept of duets. But as it came to start recording them, I realized it was really a gift, and then I threw out a lot of the songs and wrote new songs with people in mind.
How did you pick the artists to participate on the album?
I just picked my favorite people and hoped that they would show up. I mean, Russell Mayall, even though I had a slight relationship with him, because he was managed by the same people as me 15 years before that album came out, I thought, like, well, I have his home address. But I never really expected him to show up. And then he showed up, and he was so great and wonderful. And the weird thing was that the engineer was Earl Mankey, who had been in Sparks, you know, the original lineup of Sparks, so he knew Russell. And I felt like, well, they talk to each other all the time. And he said, oh, no, I haven't talked to Russell in like 10 years. This is so great for me because I get to be friends with my old friend again. So it all just happened because Russell was super nice and decided to do this project. And he did it because I said, well, why are you doing this? And he said, because it's a great song. So he not only did it, but he did it with positive feedback and goodwill. And it was really fun. And then everybody else were just people that I knew and admired. I knew Michael Quercio from the 3 o'clock, and I said, do you want to do this? And he said, yes. You know, nobody said, in fact, there were more people that said yes that I couldn't get on the album. Maria McKee actually asked to be on the album. That was really bizarre. She was a friend of a friend of a friend, and she heard the album was being made, and she said, well, why isn't there a song with me on it? And I just thought, like, God, her voice is like so from heaven. And to have someone like that ask to participate, and I didn't know her at all. So it was an amazing experience.
Christian mentioned Russell Mayall of Sparks, and their duet was Devil in My Care. Check out the Ronettes-inspired intro to the song. I went from Devil in My Care, sung with Russell Mayall of Sparks, to Madison Avenue, sung with Elvez. What is your most lyrically gay song?
Gay? Lyrically gay? Let me see. Boy, that's a hard one. You better name some names. I would have to look through the whole catalog.
Well, I wonder if a candidate would be I Could Die for Cute.
Yes, I that's a good one, because that definitely is like, I'm admitting my age, I'm looking at the young guy, he's across the room, and I'm thinking, well, I have no hope, and yet I'm going to take the plunge and approach him anyway. So that definitely is an out gay song. And that is funny, because when Steve McDonald agreed to sing on that, I specifically picked the lines that wouldn't embarrass so much. Like, he didn't have to sing Your Little Goatee, or any of those things. You know, he just got to sing I Don't Want to Be Free. So that is a very gay song. It's very openly gay.
I could die for cute. Oh, I cute. I could die for cute. Your shop on Mabel Jail, big charms, I deign to condescend. But the point is moot. With grace that's almost violent, you exit with my friend.
I don't wanna be free. No plea bargain for me. Parenthetically, I could die for cute. Simple was the way my world would end. Your little gold teeth, the way you subscribe to every trend. I admit I've got no disbelief left to suspend. But I feel cute.
Helping Christian out on the song I Could Die for Cute was Steve McDonald of the act Red Cross. One of your most recent projects was an album for Ann Magnuson called Pretty Songs and Ugly Stories from 2006. You produced and arranged the album and co-wrote most of the songs. She appeared on your duets album, and you two also go way back, right?
Oh, we sure do, yes. Well, like I told you, she directed New Wave Vaudeville, so you'd have to say that's 1977. So, and then after that, we were friends, and we did lots of projects together. We did a whole project that we wrote music to about Miss Vicky, Tiny Tim's sometime wife, and we did a project about a post-headline headless body in a topless bar. We actually have lots of songs that didn't ever get recorded. She did a big show at Lincoln Center in New York, and I wrote the theme song called Just Say Yes. And so we've been doing any sort of crazy stuff. She used to say, Aria is going to give us $1,000 if we think of something. And so we would just sit around my house and we'd brainstorm and come up like, well, what about a bummer tent? So we just, you know, we could just make jokes and have fun together. And she's, of course, an incredible actress and visionary. And she knows where to get costumes. And she's friends with all sorts of great people. So anything we did together was always fun. So we've stayed friends through the years. But I always really wanted to do her pop album, but I wanted to do an album that was really what we love together, because she loves lots and lots of other things, but what we love together is pop music.
Was one of the songs you co-wrote with her Old Enough to Be Your Mom?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that one.
Well, that song is actually part of a musical that she's in the sort of mid-writing. It's called To Big Sir with Love, and it's a specific story about an adventure she had with a younger surfer guy, if I may say that. I don't want to tread on her toes, but anyway, there's a whole lot of other ideas for that musical, but that was when she woke up in the morning and kind of realized, like, ooh, he's even younger than I thought. So the lyrics are very literal, but they're just also about, you know, the universal issue of aging. And like me, I think that she tries to take a very simple idea and a jokey idea and a one-liner idea and then extrapolate it into something that addresses some very basic human issues. But I got to bring the Leslie Gore and Leonard Cohen to it.
Let's hear a bit of the track he was talking about from Ann Magnusson's album, one with the intriguing title, Old Enough to Be Your Mom.
Says it's bad, I'm old enough to be your mom.
Since you've been doing your solo recordings, how has your music changed over the years?
I think I've changed by giving myself more license to be ridiculous and sublime. When I first started writing, I felt very constricted by what I perceived were the prejudice against my previous projects, like I just thought like the reasons that the Mumps weren't successful enough was because they were too pop when they were supposed to be rock, or, you know, the Swinging Madisons were too jokey when they were supposed to be serious, or Bleecker Street Incident was too acoustic when it should have been electric, or all these things. And I was trying to fit myself into the constraints of the time, but albeit the best constraints. Like on Earthquake Weather, I felt like this is my Elvis Costello album, where I'm really addressing what is considered quality songwriting in this era. And I thought, like, I can write better songs than him, and I'm going to do it. But after I worked with Rufus, and I do have to credit Rufus with this, he said, use fancy chords when you feel like it. Use simple chords when you feel like it. Make a verse go on too long if you feel like it. Make a verse be too short if you feel like it. Wait a long time before the chorus if you feel like it. Let the chorus arrive. It was more like he said, let things arrive as they want to arrive instead of having them arrive in the format of a sonnet or this constricting discipline. And so I do feel like my songwriting, even though I feel the pressure of writing songs that I enjoy, and I enjoy very succinct pop nuggets, I feel like I've liberated myself to be more adventurous in terms of composition, if that doesn't sound too ridiculous.
What's next for you?
Well, just my new album. And it's weird because, you know, on And, I got so used to writing with other people that now I'm going back and doing something with my voice on every song. And I'm going like, is this tiresome? Especially because, as I've told you before, I don't like my voice. But I feel like it's a really strong set of songs. I tried to edit it down to a manageable part, but my backer said, you should just do all the songs. So it's going to be 17 or 18 songs long. I'm just not going to hold back. And I'm doing what I hope will be the most pretentious thing I've ever done. So I'm just in the middle of doing that now, and I'm pretty excited about it.
What's the name of the new album?
The new album is called Fop. And I just wanted to call it something that was, first of all, true to my position as a gay elder, and also true to my position as someone who likes to be fancy. And also, you can put the letters really big on a CD, because CD packaging is unfortunately not as exciting as album packaging used to be. So
right.
If you want to make something pretty, it has to be very simple.
You're sharing with me a little bit of one of the songs. Tell me about Evil.
Well, Evil is a direct response to the Republican regime. And so Evil I wrote specifically in response to George Bush Jr. and all the horrible things that done by his regime, where I actually think never before in the history of the world were we able to bring about the actual physical end of the world without the aid of atomic or nuclear bombs. But now that we are capable of doing it, he's doing it. So Evil was kind of like about that, and it was a very specific admission, like, I didn't believe in evil before, and now I do.
And that's all I'm allowed to play, as that's an exclusive, a pre-release sampling of the song Evil from Christian's next album, FOP. I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to especially thank Christian Hoffman for the fascinating interview. His website is at www.christianhoffman.com, and Christian is spelled with a K. The site is definitely worth an extended visit, and for more info on this show, you may want to also check out my site, www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. If you are to be remembered for the writing and recording of one single song, what would it be?
I need to be remembered for my entire catalog, baby.
Pick one.
That's a very mean-spirited question, and I hate you. But I'm Scarecrow, I guess. I mean, I love Scarecrow, and sometimes I think that it's tired and it's too specific, since it's about Matthew Shepard and all that stuff. But like the occasions when I've been sort of encouraged to revisit it, because it's just been used for a movie called True Loved, and so because they wanted to license it, I actually had to listen to it and think if I can still stand that song. And I actually think, I think it's pretty successful on its own terms, you know. But I have a healthy ego, and I think a lot of my songs are successful on their own terms. I'm just waiting for the rest of the world to figure that out. So I don't really have much issue with my catalog, like I said before. I think that I may not be Leonard Cohen or Leslie Gore, but somewhere in the middle, I've made a pretty good little spot for myself.
Tell me about the work you've done with Rufus.
Well, the work I've done with Rufus is always a total surprise. I was his keyboard player, which is shocking to say because he's a much better keyboard player than I am, and I played the harpsichord parts and the string parts and the little extra parts, but I was his keyboard player for about a year and a half, and I toured with him, and I got to sing backup vocals with him, and you know, I don't know if my voice really melded with him, but every time I sang with him, I felt like I was resonating in some Tibetan bell. It just was something that you could hear when the resonances matched. And so it was really a wonderful, I've overused this word, but a wonderful gift. And also because I adored so much. The reason I met Rufus was because I wanted to meet his mom, Kate McGarrigle, who I think is one of the greatest songwriters of all time. And then by mistake, it turned out that Rufus was a great songwriter too. So I had a really happy time touring with him, but then it was over, and we were the first band he was ever in, and he was like 24 at the time, and he wanted to try out other musicians, and I just assumed, like, well, that makes sense. You know, if I were young, I'd want to try out a new flavor too. And I just thought I'd never see him again. You know, I just thought he's moving on to that world of rock stardom. He's got a big record label. I have nothing. I have a relative critical regard, but I'm very outsider independent. And yet he never fell out of touch with me, and he's continued to stay in touch with me. And so when I started to do my record, I said, you know, here's this song that I think would be pretty for your voice. Will you do it? And he said, sure. And so when he showed up and sang that, and it was so gorgeous, and I thought, like, this is, you know, who could want anything more? This is like Christmas a million times over.
Closing the show is the beautiful song Scarecrow with Rufus Wainwright, from Christian's Duets album, And.
and